three-part series on the workshop on the Hazardous Waste Generator Improvements Rule, brought to you by EPA's Office of Resource Conservation and Recovery. I'm going to go ahead and call up the presentation materials and turn things over to your very first presenter today, Kathy Lett, who's joining us from EPA. Kathy, whenever the materials load and you're ready, feel free to begin.
Okay, great. Thanks, Jean. Welcome, everyone. We're really glad to be able to present this training to this state and EPA group. We have tried to get out and do a bunch of these trainings in person, but we know that they were not available to everyone, so we're glad to have this series of webinars in order to reach people about the generator rule. Please use the question box. Like Jean mentioned, we'll be addressing all the questions at the end after we present our materials, but they will add to the discussion greatly to have that back and forth in the questions. So we look forward to that part of the presentation. Today we're going to be running through the first two modules of our training, which will cover some background material. I know probably there are a lot of you who are RCRA experts, but there may be some who are not. So we're going to run through some background material there, and also we're going to talk about some of the provisions of the rule. We're going to jump right into that. So I guess let's get started. For the first module, we're going to talk about the purpose of our training, like I said, a background, some history, and the goals of the rule. We're going to try to run through that part pretty fast, because some of it will be a review for people. And then also we're going to talk about the reorganization of the generator regulations, some of the new definitions, and some of the revisions to 262.10. So the purpose of our training today is to spread awareness of the new rule to the states. Not so new anymore, but some of the states are just coming around and picking it up. We're glad to see that our map is filling up. We'll be looking at that later. We're also going to be describing and explaining in lots of detail the provisions of the rule and how it might affect you guys as state implementers, and also how it's going to affect the generators that you're dealing with on a day-to-day basis. We're going to do the question and answer session, and then we'd also, at any point in the process, either in your comments or your questions or at the very end of the three webinars, talk about what other kinds of training and outreach materials would be useful to all of you. We do have some updates in that area that we're going to be excited to announce are coming pretty soon, so we are also interested in learning what is most useful to you. As far as background, this slide just grounds us all in the basics of the goals of RCRA when we're talking about the generator rule. The most relevant of RCRA's program goals for the generator rule is making the revisions to the program that still protect human health and the environment. So that's the first goal, protecting human health and the environment, conserving energy and natural resources, and reducing the amount of waste generated. When we discuss the Hazardous Waste Generator Improvements Rule, we're talking about hazardous waste, so that's as opposed to municipal solid waste or industrial, non-hazardous industrial waste. And we also just want to make clear to everyone that the generator rule does not address the household hazardous waste exemption, and we didn't make any changes to that. And then within the hazardous waste regulatory program, as you would expect, we're almost entirely going to be talking about the generator program regulations within, as part of this rule, so within the three webinars. As far as waste generation categories for the generators, the next two slides just quickly go over that in case there's anyone out there who's not familiar with the terms we're going to be using throughout the webinar. They are very small quantity generators is the smallest category of generators. That is a change in just the term that we're using. These were the generators that used to be called conditionally exempt small quantity generators. We did not change the category, just the name. It was a term that we thought was more accurately representing what these generators were. And some of the states had already adopted that term, so we went ahead and did so too. Also, small quantity generators and large quantity generators. This is just a visual representation of how the different categories play out. So for the history of the rule, most of the generator rules were promulgated in the 1980s. I'm not going to go too far into the details of these slides, but over the years we conducted several program evaluations, including a major one in 2004, where we reached out to try and see what we could do to improve the generator program. And we received a lot of comments, as you might be able to imagine, and they included simplifying the regulations, eliminating cross-referencing within the regulations, codifying some of the long-standing guidance that the office here had put out but wasn't in the regs. There were also program changes such as providing flexibility for episodic generators, requiring re-notification for small quantity generators, and making some changes to the emergency planning, particularly contingency planning. So those were some of the things we heard in 2004. We did what we could after 2004 without taking regulatory action, because that's a major step. So we did some changes to the website, released additional guidance. We did do a technical corrections rule. And we also dug in a little deeper with further evaluation into the comments that we had gotten in 2004. After all that, we still determined that we needed a rule, proposed something in 2015, got about 230 public comments from the states and local governments. If any of you guys commented, thank you very much. Those are very useful to us. Please continue to do that. Also from academic institutions, industry, waste management, most of the usual suspects in the comments for the waste office. These comments covered all aspects of the rule, basically everything that we had proposed. So we went ahead and finalized in 2016. Okay. So I do want to touch on the generator universe. We tend to look at them from a global perspective here at EPA headquarters, looking at the whole country when we're making our changes, and try to remember that the changes that we're making to the regs do affect all these different entities. But I find it useful just to get a sense of how many VSQGs there are, SQGs, and LQGs. As you can see from the chart, the numbers for the SQGs and the VSQGs are estimated. We looked at the data that we had over the years. But we did have to estimate those numbers, and we'll probably be talking about this chart and the numbers for SQGs again a little bit later in 2 weeks, I guess, when we talk about SQG renotification. So after all that process, we got to the goals of our final rule, and we decided that we wanted to reorganize our regulations. We got so many comments about how to reading the regs was complicated, and there was a lot of cross-referencing and jumping back and forth. We lived that too, so we recognized that that was an important goal. We also wanted to provide greater flexibility in some areas. We wanted to strengthen environmental protection. We had identified some gaps in the regulations, and we wanted to use this opportunity to strengthen the protection by closing those gaps, and then clarifying some areas of the rule that were ambiguous and thought that we could improve compliance by doing that clarification. So we went ahead and tied, everything that we did in the rule went ahead and tied back to one of these goals, or several of them in some cases. So I'm going to start by jumping into the regs, talking with a substantive discussion of the reorganization. It is an overarching feature of the changes to the regs. And also looking at this will provide us with a bit of a roadmap for our sessions on the generator rule. So what we learned and had been digging into when we made this change was that the generator rules seem to be particularly confusing in their setup. And we thought that through reorganization, we could make them be more logical. We could provide a section of the regulations for each generator category, which would make the provisions easier to find. That would also help our compliance if we could help smaller entities find the regulations that apply to them, not make it so difficult to find them in the regulations. So we did that. We also thought that the new organization of the regs would more easily absorb any future changes, should any be made. Basically, if you look at the slide, what you'll see is that when a generator goes into the regs, they'll see that the generator category determination, which used to be 261.5, that was moved to 262.13. VSQG provisions used to be several different paragraphs in 261.5 of the federal regs. Those are now all in 262.14. Satellite areas are in 262.15. SQG provisions are in 16, and LQG provisions are in 17. We also have a detailed handout that looks at the crosswalk of the old regs to the new ones that should be available in your resources tab. So if you go ahead and look in there, you should be able to find it. We also changed some of the definitions. We're going to be using these definitions throughout our presentation, so I'm just going to go over them quickly. Acute hazardous waste and non-acute hazardous waste, they're not really new terms, but we did start using them in the regulations, and we didn't, the old regulations used to kind of do an explanation for what acute hazardous waste was, and we thought it would be easier just to define it. So we put those definitions in there. Central accumulation area, that is a term for what we have always called a 90 or 180-day accumulation area, which is a bit of a mouthful. And so this was a term that was used in the labs rule and was used in a lot of our guidance, so we thought we should define it. We didn't change really what that means. We just gave the term a definition. I do like to point out that just because we use the word central, some people have found it a little misleading. That doesn't require the area to be in some sort of central location on the site. That's not part of the definition. And it also doesn't mean that a generator can't have more than one 90 or 180-day accumulation area. It just means that it's the area that the waste accumulates in. If after it's been moved from a satellite area, if the facility has them. We also put definitions in for large quantity, small quantity, and very small quantity generator, as those terms were either not in the regulations or in the case of a small quantity generator was outdated. Finally, I'm just going to talk quickly about some revisions we made to 262.10. It has been revised in quite a significant way. It's going to look quite different if you're familiar with the old federal regs here. In some cases, that meant removing some obsolete provisions, such as the paragraph that refers to laboratory XLs. We also had to make some updates throughout there that had to do with the new structure of the regulations. A few of the paragraphs are unchanged. The other thing that we tried to do with 262.10 was to really make it a roadmap for what the generator would know to look for when it went to 262 in order to figure out what the regulations were. So the new 262.10, it lists both the independent requirements and the conditions for exemption for each generator category. I think a lot of the states were already familiar with those two terms and the distinction between them as far as independent requirements being something that generators have to do whether or not they're accumulating, and the conditions for the exemption being the requirements that tie in when the generator is using its exemption from the permitting authority. So 262.10 lists each generator category, what its independent requirements are. For the conditions for exemption, it points the generators to where they're going to find their conditions for exemption. And then it also states right there in 262.10 that hazardous waste must be sent to a designated facility, meaning either a permitted TSDF or a recycler. We also made some corresponding revisions to 262.10G. I think that covers my materials, so Mary Beth is going to really jump into the meat of it now that you've been warmed up and talk about hazardous waste determinations.
Okay, so as I'm sure most of you are aware, the first step in the hazardous waste process is determining whether you actually have a hazardous waste or not. This was always in our regulations since RCRA came about, but what we did in this rule was we greatly expanded the regulatory text for 262.11, which is where the requirements for making a hazardous waste determination are found. So this first slide just gives you kind of an overview to the changes. We clarified and emphasized that the waste determination has to be accurate. We confirmed when a generator has to make the hazardous waste determination. We greatly expanded on how to determine if a solid waste is either listed and or characteristic. We reiterated what waste determination records must be kept. And then finally, we require SQGs and LQGs to put the hazardous waste codes on the containers prior to shipping off-site. So much of this was already in preamble and guidance, but we decided that it was important to add to the regulations so that we could emphasize the importance of this. It's kind of key to managing hazardous waste properly is to, you know, make an accurate hazardous waste determination. As Kathy mentioned, early when we first started talking about redoing the generator regulations, we did a couple program evaluations and we talked to a lot of states and we looked at different analysis, and we found that this was an area where there was a fairly significant degree of noncompliance. And, you know, with the number of generators out there, even a noncompliance rate of 10% could be a fairly significant number of violations. So we decided that, you know, this was something that we wanted to try to improve and to emphasize the importance and also to make sure that, you know, hazardous waste is managed properly. So as I think most of you are aware, it starts with the statutory definition of solid waste. So before you determine if you have a hazardous waste, you have to make sure you have a solid waste. And this slide shows the definition from the statute. It's basically, you know, any garbage, refuse, sludge, etc., and other discarded materials. It can be solid, liquid, semi-solid, or contain gas. It doesn't have to be in the physical solid state. But if you're going to dispose of it, then it's likely a solid waste. The next chart just gives you kind of a generic process flow diagram to kind of put things in context. Generally, at a manufacturer, you have chemicals that are used to produce a product. They run through the production process and out comes the product, but also there's usually some kind of residuals associated. And those are the things that you have to determine if they're solid and or hazardous waste. If you're going to recycle them, then they may not be solid waste. But if you're not going to recycle them, you're going to dispose of them, then they are solid waste, and then you have to determine if they're hazardous waste. So the first part of 26211, we're going to kind of walk through the new language, and then at the very end of this part of the presentation, I'll show you how that compares to the old language. But the first part is 26211A. This is where the generator has to make the hazardous waste determination. So you've determined you have a solid waste, and now you have to determine if it's hazardous. So the first point is you have to make it at the point of generation. It has to be made before any dilution, mixing, or other alteration of the waste occurs. And then the third point is that if there is any potential for the characteristics of the waste to change, the properties such that the RCRA classification would change, then you would have to do another waste determination. I'm going to go through all these points individually. Okay. So the point of generation. We think this is, you know, it makes the most sense. We think the statute's clear about what generation is. It's the process of producing hazardous waste. So you have to do it at the point of generation because this is the point where you would start managing it as hazardous waste. So you would, it's important because this is where you would make the proper waste identification, you would handle it from cradle to grave properly, and also this would ensure you're complying with land disposal restrictions, which is a part of RCRA we're not going to get into today, but it's a part that generators and treatment, storage, and disposal facilities have to worry about if they're land disposing. So you also need to make the hazardous waste determination before any dilution, mixing, or other alteration of the waste occurs. We added this language to the reg text so it's clear that you can't, basically you can't treat the waste to render it non-hazardous and then be out of RCRA because by saying you're making your determination afterwards. An example that has come up over the years is, you know, people are like, well, you know, we let our organic solvents volatilize and then they're no longer ignitable or flammable, for example. Well, that's illegal treatment, basically. And if you made the waste determination at the right point, which is before that, then you would know you can't just let solvents volatilize because containers have to be covered. And then the last point of this section of the regs, 26211A, is that you have to make the determination at any time in the course of the management of that waste if it could change from non-hazardous to hazardous waste, for example. So why did we include this statement? Well, most of the time the waste generators would make their waste determination and the waste wouldn't change. So they wouldn't need to do this. But we have become aware over the years of situations where sometimes the waste changes and it's caused problems. For example, it might have been non-hazardous at the beginning, but over time, if it was like a solvent water mixture, over time it settles into two phases and the solvent phase is actually flammable and it can cause problems like fires, etc. Or another situation we've heard of is waste that was sent to municipal solid waste landfills and then because of exposure to the atmosphere or to exposure to other chemicals ended up causing fires in the landfills. So that waste actually turned reactive because of its exposure to the elements. So those are a couple situations. So this doesn't mean you have to monitor your waste 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It means you need to know enough, the generator needs to know enough to make sure that they properly manage it all the way through. We've also emphasized in the preamble that a couple things related to this is that generators can decide to manage their non-hazardous waste as hazardous waste if they so choose. That's allowable. We've said this in preamble and memos over the years, but you know, sometimes they have a waste that might be borderline. You know, sometimes it has enough of the heavy metal to be TC, sometimes it's under. If they want to always handle it as hazardous, then that's their prerogative, and we're okay with that. Generally, that means that they're making the choice to manage it as in the most environmentally protective way they can. The other thing we're emphasizing with this is that if you have an unknown waste and you're waiting on test results, you do need to manage it as hazardous waste until the test results come back. And that's because if you don't, and you know the test results could take 30, 45 days, that's all that time it's not being managed as a hazardous waste. And there's time limits on how long a generator can hold on to it. So that's why we're saying you do need to manage it as hazardous waste until you get confirmation. If it turns out it's not hazardous, then the generator can simply remove the labels and start managing it as non-hazardous waste. All right, 262.11b is the next section. This language has not changed. It's just put into a different section of 262.11. But basically, once you determine you've made your solid waste determination, and you should look at the 261.4 exclusions to see if any of those would apply. Okay, so now getting into another section that did have some significant changes. 262.11c is where we talk about how you know if you've generated a listed hazardous waste. And so if it's not excluded, then you have to use knowledge to see if it meets any of the listings. Those are in 261 subpart D. And we now include in the regulations a list of what is acceptable generator knowledge to see if you have a listed waste. It can include things like waste origin, composition, the process producing the waste, feedstocks, and other relevant and reliable information, such as the regulatory language of the listing can be helpful. Sometimes it's even helpful to go back to the original Federal Register notice where EPA describes, you know, the intent of the listing, background documents, etc. And then, of course, if you have a waste that's listed, but you know that you don't use the same process that it was originally listed for, so that some of the hazardous constituents wouldn't be in it, then you do have the option of filing for a delisting petition, which is explained in the regulations at 260.20 and 260.22. So this would only be in cases where, you know, the process has changed enough that you wouldn't have those hazardous constituents that it was originally listed for. Okay, so then 262.11d basically does the same thing, but this is for characteristic waste. I'm sure most of you know, but there's four hazardous waste characteristics. The first one is ignitability. These are things that are flammable, can cause fires, etc. The second one is corrosivity. That's either low or high pH, things like acids and bases. And then the third characteristic is reactivity. That's materials that can cause explosions or other violent reactions. And then the last one is the toxicity characteristic. And this is a list of about 40 hazardous constituents. You run the TCLP and you see if your waste has enough, you know, over the level for the TC for lead or mercury, for example. Okay, so then how do you determine if you have a characteristic hazardous waste? You can use knowledge, so you still are allowed to use your knowledge, and that would mean, you know, knowledge of how the waste was generated. It can also include things like what are the feedstocks and any other inputs to the production process, knowledge about the byproducts and intermediates from the production or the manufacturing process, the chemical or physical characterization of the waste, information about the properties of the chemicals used to produce that waste or otherwise contained in the waste, and testing that illustrates the properties of the waste. Now, testing, if you use a test method that's not set out in 261, subpart C, which is where the characteristics are, that is allowed. You can use that. However, that is considered part of the generator's knowledge if it's not actually listed in 261 subpart C. So like I mentioned, those are non-regulatory tests. They can be part of the generator's knowledge. They can provide relevant information. They're just not considered definitive by themselves. So for example, one is if you have total concentrations in the waste instead of running the TCLP, you can use that information to determine without maybe going through the whole TCLP process. If it's like a lot, then you could, if it's way over the TC level, then you can say it's definitely hazardous waste for whatever constituent you were looking at, or if it's well under, but there's a kind of a simple formula you can use. And there's also some in the SW846, there's also some guidance tests in there that can help you determine, but that would be based on, that would be considered part of the generator's knowledge. If the generator's knowledge is inadequate to make an accurate determination, then you do have to use the test methods that are in 261 subpart C. And as part of that, the person testing the waste has to do representative sampling. And then as long as the results or the test is performed properly, the results of a regulatory test, one of those that are listed in 261 subpart C, would be considered definitive for determining the regulatory status of the waste. And just a reminder that even if the waste is listed, the generator still does need to determine if it also exhibits a characteristic. And this is in order to make sure they comply with the land disposal restrictions. So for example, if you have, say, spent solvents that are listed, like F001 through F005, those would have LDR requirements related to the spent solvent listing. But if you use that solvent in a process where it's used to clean up metal parts, for example, you may pick up some heavy metals that would make it TC for lead or cadmium or something like that. So that's the reason in that situation you have to see if it also exhibits a toxicity characteristic, because the land disposal restriction for the solvent listing wouldn't take care of the metal. So that's one example where it's important to do both. Okay, so now you know if you have a characteristic and or listed waste. So then you would go on to the next part, 26211E, just tells you that this language has not changed, and this just points you to the rest of the regulations to look at for management of that specific waste. Now, 26211F is the record-keeping requirement. I mentioned earlier that small and large quantity generators are required to keep records of their hazardous waste determination to show how they made the determination. That includes their acceptable knowledge. They have to keep the records at least 3 years from the date when the waste was last sent off-site or to on-site treatment, storage, or disposal. And they must include, but aren't limited to, the following types of information: the results of any tests, sampling, waste analysis, or other determinations, records documenting that these tests and sampling and analytical methods were valid, and the relevance of those tests, the records they used to determine the process from which the waste was generated, the composition and the properties of the waste, and any records that explain the knowledge basis as described in 40 CFR 26211D. So if the generator is using his knowledge to make the determination, then they have to keep records showing that. And if they're using testing, they have to keep those records. And this basic record-keeping requirement already existed. It was in 26240. But we moved it into 26211F so that if you're doing your waste determination, the record-keeping requirement is right there. There is still a reference in 26240 so that generators, if they just look at the record-keeping, they would see that. But this 26211F is in much more detail than it used to be. And the last piece of 26211G is the RCRA waste codes. This is where small and large quantity generators have to put on the waste codes prior to shipping the waste off-site. So they're required to either mark the containers with those waste codes, or we did allow them to use an electronic means such as barcoding. But the key here is that whatever they use, it has to tie the waste codes to that individual container so that someone will know exactly which container has which waste in it. And we do know that, you know, a lot of bigger waste management companies have been using things like this for a while. So we did build that into the regulation that's okay as long as it's, as long as the generator can tell you which container has which waste code. Okay, and like I said at the end, here is a comparison of the new language versus the old 26211. So the hazardous waste determination stayed in the same section. It's just, I'd say, greatly beefed up. And the red language on the left-hand column shows you the new language. So it's all about, you know, it has to be accurate. 262A, about when you make the determination, and then 26211C is where what you do to determine if it's listed, and that shows you all of the acceptable knowledge, that what is acceptable knowledge for generators, and then this is 26211D, so the same thing about for characteristics. There's a lot of reg text that explains acceptable knowledge for that. And then the last two new sections are the record keeping and the requirement to put the waste codes on containers. So now I'm going to turn it back to Kathy to talk about counting.
Okay. So like the regulations designed through the reorganizations themselves, our presentation runs through them in the order more or less that a generator would be exposed to them. 262.12, if you go to the regs now, you'll see that is reserved. So the next thing after the generator makes their determination is that generator has to count its waste to determine if it's a VSQG, an SQG, or an LQG. like a lot of what Mary Beth said, this requirement itself is not new. It just hadn't really been presented clearly in the regulations before. 261.5 had a couple of paragraphs that merely listed the materials that didn't have to be counted, and it did have some discussion of mixing VSQG waste with solid waste, but it didn't say anything else about counting or determining generator category. In our discussions, we found that big LQGs who have, you know, EH&S staff didn't really have a problem with this, but smaller companies, SQGs, small businesses, it was helpful to talk about this as a step that they had to complete. So the new 262.13 contains that information that was in 261.5, and then it also provides a process for counting and specifics about how to count if a generator has multiple broad types of waste, so acute hazardous waste and non-acute hazardous waste, or hazardous waste and cleanup residues of acute hazardous waste. Also in 262.13, you'll find the mixing regulations that were moved from 261.5. Today we're going to run through the actual language of the provision, much like we just did for 262.11. The introductory text of 262.13 does three things. It states that the generator must determine its generator category. It states that that category is based on the amount of hazardous waste that's generated in a calendar month. And it also states that the generator's category can change month to month. These counting requirements, as many of you probably know, are based on the RCRA statute and are also critical to the framework of the generator regulations regarding VSQGs, SQGs, and LQGs. We do want to note that the text does not say that the exact counting procedures that are in the regs have to be followed each month point by point, but that the overarching requirement is that the category must be determined every month. For instance, a generator that's on the bubble of a higher category should probably, count exactly to figure out what category they're in. But a generator that knows that they're solidly in one category or another, although they do need to know how much waste they have, they don't have to follow these procedures. Obviously, they may have another way that they are knowing what category they're in and how much waste they're generating. Moving on. 262.13A. is where the regs present basic procedures for determining generator category. If the generator is only generating non-acute hazardous waste or only generating acute hazardous waste. 262.13 is procedures for determining generator category if the generator is generating a combination of acute and non-acute hazardous waste. C and D are those lists that were moved from 261.5. Of those things that don't have to be included when the generator is counting its hazardous waste. We've also added in there hazardous waste from an episodic event that doesn't have to be counted. And I believe now there is an additional thing in there from the farms rule that will be effective later this year about not counting pharmaceutical waste. That all has to be done under subpart P. And then 262.13E is a statement that just moves the generator on to the next part of the regs. So saying that the generator has to use the category that it's determined to identify which regulations apply. As far as generating acute and non-acute hazardous waste in the same month, as we were promulgating the definitions for each category of generator, we did have to address in the regs how to count when acute and non-acute hazardous waste were generated in the same month. That was a question that kept coming up. So we did find when we were looking into this as part of the proposal that we had conflicting guidances on this point. One was from the Federal Register of November 19th, 1980, which said that waste should be handled the same if the generator has acute and non-acute hazardous waste. But then we found a letter from 1987 that said that the waste could be managed in separate categories. Obviously, this is something we needed to figure out in the final rule. So what we determined was that having one category per month makes the most sense, both practically and regulatorily. There are still complicated scenarios that are unavoidable because of the way that a generator category can change month to month. But we did determine that in any given month, what was most clear was to have one category for a generator. So that was what we determined in this final rule. Finally, we placed this table that you see on the slide in front of you in the regulations. You can find it in 262.13. And what it does is it provides the five scenarios that a generator might find themselves in if it's generating different broad types of waste. The information in this table syncs up with the definitions that are in 260.10. So basically the first three lines you'll see are all for large quantity generators, and that is if the generator is generating above the threshold for acute hazardous waste, which is 1 kilogram, above the threshold for non-acute hazardous waste, 1,000 kilograms, or above the threshold for residues from a cleanup of acute hazardous waste, which is 100 kilograms. A generator is a small quantity generator if it's below the threshold for acute hazardous waste and for cleanups, so less than 1 kilogram of acute hazardous waste, less than 100 kilograms of residues, and if it falls between 100 kilograms and 1,000 kilograms of non-acute hazardous waste, and then if it's below all three thresholds, it's a very small quantity generator. So this is in the regs now. Like we did before for hazardous waste determinations, we've provided here for you to go back and look at later if you care to. Can I skip a slide? I think there might be something missing. Somewhere. So this is the red line. Oh no, I've just got it wrong. So there's 262.13 is new. A and B are new, all red line. And then here is the old language that we moved with very few changes from 265, C and D. And then the new statement in 262.13E, telling the generator to use what category they're in to figure out what regulations they need to comply with. So that's counting. There's also mixing regulations in this section of the regs. Basically, the mixing regulations for VSUGs were, as I noted before, in 261.5, because that section's going away. They were moved here. 262.13 is the new home for the mixing regs. And then it also provides some more specific language about how mixing works for VSUGs, and is also more explicit about mixing for SUGs and LQGs than we were before. We think the new regs are more clear, but the information that you're going to see when you look at these should be familiar if you knew the old rules. So first of all, the language does address the VSUGs, and it states that they can mix hazardous waste and solid waste and not have to count the mixture, all as hazardous waste, in two circumstances. Those two circumstances are if the mixture does not cause the VSQG to exceed its monthly generation amounts. So that's the first scenario. And the second scenario is if the mixture does exceed generation limits for the VSQG, but it does not exhibit a characteristic of hazardous waste. So those are the two scenarios where VSQGs can mix and not have to count that whole mixture. So if the VSQG waste is mixed to amounts that exceed the limit and it is characteristic, that mixture, then they have a hazardous waste at the higher generation amount. So those are the key points from this slide and from the mixing for VSQGs. As far as SQGs and LQGs, we did think that it would be useful to mention mixing in the regulations for those two categories and to have references for the relevant provisions that they can look at right here in 262, because they have to go elsewhere in the regs to find them. So what we did was we added references to the mixture rule in 261.3. That's what applies to SQGs and LQGs. It basically says that mixtures of listed and solid waste are still hazardous waste, and then, of course, provides some exceptions. Other things that apply for mixing would be the dilution prohibition, land disposal restrictions, and the need for the generator to make a hazardous waste determination. So those are all things that we thought would be valuable to mention in the regs regarding mixing. We don't want to spend too much time on the details here of things that haven't really changed, but we did want to make sure that we mentioned that a mixture of hazardous and solid waste cannot be done in order to dilute a characteristic out of the hazardous waste. But it can be done if the solid waste possesses a unique property to remove the characteristic. We could probably sit down and talk for hours about this particular point, but we're not going to. We just wanted to make sure that since we were talking about mixing, we did mention this distinction in the regs between mixing and dilution. I think I did mostly talk about the reasoning behind the changes already, but mostly the idea was to make sure that the mixing regs went to a reasonable place, which we thought was in with the counting and with making a generator category determination, and also to clarify an area where we had gotten quite a few questions and to make sure that SQGs and LQGs are getting this information about mixing right there in 262 without having to know that they should also be reading 261.3. So that's mixing, and I'm going to turn it over to my colleague Brian to talk about marking and labeling.
All right, thanks. So this is the last section for today's presentation, so hang in there. The changes that we made to the marking and labeling requirements are considered more stringent, and that means that all 50 states are going to have to eventually adopt that part of the rule. So one of the reasons why we decided to make these changes is we believe that the information that was required by the previous regulations wasn't descriptive enough, and so we wanted to improve the regulatory clarity and user-friendliness of the regs. Over time had received repeated requests from states and emergency responders that they wanted to see more information on containers. And we also wanted to make the marking and labeling requirements consistent since they apply throughout the hazardous waste regulations. So what did we change? First of all, we implemented a two-prong requirement for all containers during accumulation that they have to be labeled with the words hazardous waste and a description of the hazards of the contents. So we pretty much changed the word and to an or, because previously generators could choose to do one or the other. Now they have to do both. For containment buildings, they are required to be labeled with the same information, but because they're different physical form than a container, the labels have to be placed in a specific location, or excuse me, in a conspicuous location. And some of the benefits of the new marking and labeling requirements are better risk communication, particularly for workers and first responders. And our hope is that they will assist them in taking proper precautions when responding to an incident. And although these new requirements are considered more stringent, we also added in some flexibility. Generators can choose to either write the words that describe the hazards of the contents, or they can use an established hazard communication method, and the keyword here is established. DOT, OSHA, and NFPA all have their own established methods. So the next couple slides are examples of HAZCOM labels that sufficiently indicate the hazards of the waste. And so this is for the second prong of the labeling requirements. This slide shows RCRA characteristic hazard labels. It actually takes care of both prongs. It has the words hazardous waste on it. It shows a pictogram of the hazard, and it also has words that indicate the hazard. So it takes care of the second prong kind of in two different ways. These are some examples of the DOT placarding system. It also kind of goes beyond the bare minimum of the requirement in that it has the words that describe the hazard on the placard, as well as kind of a pictogram that describes what it is. And we also, this is the system that we expect most generators are going to use, because they're eventually, they'll have to put these placards on their containers anyways before shipping the containers off-site. And I'll also note that this system would have to also have the words hazardous waste on the label somewhere. This is an example of the OSHA pictogram system. It's an example of a system that doesn't have any words on it, but it still meets the requirements. These are toxic and examples of toxic and reactive labels. And again, they would have to also say hazardous waste to meet both prongs of the standard. And this is an example of an NFPA chemical hazard label. It's a little bit less intuitive to kind of read than the previous examples, but it is considered an established HAZCOM system, so that would meet that second prong, and also this would have to say the words hazardous waste as well. We receive quite a few questions, we receive the same question a number of times. And people ask us whether or not waste codes are sufficient to indicate the hazards of the contents of a container, and the simple answer is no, because waste codes don't describe the hazard in words, and it's not a recognized or established HAZCOM system. So just a couple more details about the requirements. I already mentioned the part about the added flexibility, so I'll just clarify a couple things. Labeling should be taking place at the point of generation, so that means that a generator, at the same time that they're doing their waste determinations, they should also be labeling their containers. Also, if you have a situation where you have a container full of a lot of smaller containers, so an example would be a box full of vials from a lab, the generator can either choose to label the outer container according to the requirements, or put a tag on each individual container or vial that meets the requirements. And also, if there is a situation where a waste is still in the original manufacturer's packaging, the verbiage on the manufacturer packaging would be considered sufficient to meet the description part of the requirement, and you would just have to, or the generator would just have to write the words hazardous waste on the package. So Mary Beth kind of already went through this, but I'll talk again about the pre-transport labeling requirements. So if this is when a generator is getting ready to send their shipment off-site, that third requirement comes into play. The generators have to add all applicable waste codes to the containers. That way, the TSDF will be able to know what exactly it is that they're receiving and how they'll be able to treat that waste, or if they can even accept that shipment in the first place. The waste codes can be handwritten, typed, or they can also use alternative methods like barcoding and RFIDs, but like Mary Beth said, the main idea is that you need to be able to tie the specific waste codes to a specific container so everybody knows exactly what's inside. And this is an example of a label that meets all of the accumulation and pre-transport requirements. It has the words hazardous waste on it. It has a description in words of the hazards, and it also has the waste codes. And just this example only has one waste code on it, but if there were multiple waste codes, it would have to have all of them listed as well. And just a couple more general points. The areas that are affected by the new marking and labeling standards include SAAs and CAAs, transfer facilities that are consolidating hazardous waste from different generators, as well as generator container and tank storage areas at TSDS. And I'll just also note that the new marking and labeling requirements didn't change the accumulation start dates for CAAs. And with that, that concludes the presentation portion of the day. I guess we will move on to questions.
Great. Thanks, you guys. This is Christina Carrion. I'm going to pose some of our questions to our speakers for today. While we're on marking and labeling, we got a few questions coming in that you already answered, but just to reiterate maybe a small point in one of them was, do the waste codes need to be marked on the container only at some point before being sent off-site or at all times while in the central accumulation area?
Yeah, so the requirement is that they have to be put on the containers immediately prior to being shipped off-site. So they do not have, the waste codes themselves do not have to be on at the central accumulation area. We do realize some generators do, and that's fine if they do it earlier, but the requirement is immediately before being shipped off-site.
Okay, great. Another labeling type question was, what label does EPA require for containers of unknown waste being tested or analyzed?
Okay, so then you have to manage it as hazardous waste. So you would be labeling it with the words hazardous waste. You'd have the accumulation start date, and then you do have to at least attempt to indicate the hazards. So probably what's easiest would be to use the RCRA characteristic that you think it may be that you're getting it tested for. And then if it turns out it's not, you can remove the label.
Yeah, some generators also use pending analysis type sticker so that later they can go back and take that off, you know, once they've done their analysis.
Thank you. Great. Another related question. What is the best way to manage multiple labels posted on the same container, possibly indicating that the container has incompatible waste? For example, reactive versus oxidizer versus flammable. Do we have any best management practice for something like that?
I guess I'm a little confused by the question, so maybe you could, I don't know if you're trying to, you want to label it with the characteristic so that it's not mixed with incompatibles. I think, yeah, I think if it's pretty clear, like, you don't want to keep reactive waste with, so I think the characteristic would probably be the clearest, but I don't know if that's, when you say multiple labels on the same container, I'm a little confused.
I mean, maybe the question is from an enforcement standpoint, like if you go in and you see that a container has a concerning number of labels.
That might be incompatible.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess then the inspector, I think you would have to find out some more, you know, ask some questions and find out exactly what waste they're dealing with.
Yeah, that would be a red flag, I would say. Particularly if, I mean, if some of those labels are not accurate, then I think that that's a potential violation right there.
Right.
So.
Okay, thanks. So one more label type question. DOT miscellaneous class 9 can indicate anything from cotton, first aid kits, or reflectoxicity characteristic debris. Because this label is so broadly used, will it be considered an adequate hazard label by EPA?
Yeah, we've gotten this question. Yeah, DOT class 9 by itself, I think we would say is not adequate because it doesn't give you enough information to address the hazard.
This is a very popular topic, so label it. Let's try one more. If a facility uses a pending analysis label awaiting a lab analysis, do they also need to include the hazardous waste label and description?
Yeah, they would at least need the words hazardous waste and some indication of the hazards. But they could say hazardous waste pending analysis or something like that.
Yeah, some of the facilities we've heard from like to do that, so that if it comes back as non-hazardous, they have, you know, some sort of record that they can take those, they can take those labels off before sending it off-site. They can say either because of their internal procedures or it makes them feel more comfortable regulatorily that they they're in a position to take a label off a container. As far as compliance with the regs, if you know, the pending analysis sticker wouldn't be required by us, but if one of, you know, our inspectors or your inspectors came in and found a drum that didn't have any labels on it, and the facility said, oh, that one's pending analysis, and we tested and found it to be hazardous, then that would be a violation. So that's kind of, so the pending analysis is something that we know people do, so we like to talk about it, but that part of the label is not required.
Okay, great. We're going to take a break from labels right now, and we're going to move to something that you guys have scheduled to talk about next session, but if we could talk a little bit about it in terms of counting. The question is, if episodic events do not need to be counted, is an episodic event defined?
Yeah, so this is Kathy. We will use this as a advertisement for our session next week, where we will be talking about episodic events for about half of the session. We really, really get into it in the next module. It is a hazard of splitting this up from week to week is that the topics do intermingle in that way. But there is a lot of information if you want to go read ahead in the regulations. That's subpart L of part 262, and it talks about what an episodic event is and what all the requirements are, and how, you know, what the generator has to do because they're not counting it as part of the regular hazardous waste. But yes, we will be talking about that.
Okay, great. We have a mixing question. For VSQGs, I think you answered this, but let's reiterate. Can they mix a listed hazardous waste, and if the resulting waste is not characteristic hazardous, is it still considered hazardous waste?
Okay, so this is an area that is difficult. So I'm just gonna look at my notes to make sure that I get it right. So basically what it is that the VSQG can mix hazardous waste and solid waste. So that would be listed or characteristic hazardous waste and solid waste, and not have to count that mixture as all hazardous waste. One, if they don't go over the mixing limit or the generation limit for the month, or if the mixture does not exhibit a characteristic. So the amount, the listed hazardous waste that they generated is still listed hazardous waste that they generated. They still have to count that. But if they mix it with something else and all of a sudden find themselves above 100 kilograms, then they don't have to count the whole mixture. Hopefully that answers your question.
And just to make sure everyone knows, some states are definitely more stringent in this area. So
in all parts of this area, right?
Right.
Like they don't necessarily have VSQGs, or they have it at lower levels, or they have different rules about mixing, and they have different rules of where VSQGs can send their waste.
So just be sure that you check with the state.
Well, you are the state, but make sure that generators should be advised if they're asking you questions about this, that it's an area where the states all differ.
All right, I think we're back to labeling questions. Let's see if we have any information for this one. What label needs to be placed on excluded recyclable material? Are there any changes under the new regulations? With a follow-up of ERM container. Perhaps that's something.
Oh, like excluded recyclable material.
Yeah.
No, I mean, if it's excluded, so if the generator is looking at a waste that's excluded, like under a definition of solid waste exemption, then, they're going to have to follow whatever conditions are in the exemption. I don't know if, do any of them have labeling requirements?
I think it may be the relatively new definition of solid waste ones may require it to be labeled hazardous secondary material.
Yeah, that might be right. Yeah, but once, if it's a definition of solid waste exemption, then for that material specifically, you're out of 262 as a hazardous waste generator, although because it's an exemption, a conditional exemption, they would have to look at the conditions and make sure they're following those. Yeah, Mary Beth's looking to see if she can locate whether there's a hazardous secondary material and HSM labeling requirement in 261.4.
The new ones are A23, 24, and 25. But, I'm not sure. I'll keep looking.
Okay. Okay, I think we just have one more question, which I think Brian went over, but let's reiterate. A pictogram depicting corrosivity without the words corrosive would meet the indication of the hazard, correct?
If it's part of an established HAZCOM system, then yes.
Okay, great.
You can't just kind of draw your own picture of corrosivity, but yeah, it has to be an established system.
NOAA has let us know that some conditional exemptions do have labeling requirements, such as solvent-contaminated wipes. So, thank you, Hawaii.
I think that's the last of the questions that I see. Yeah,
okay.
I thought there was, did I miss this one? Someone asked, I guess 563, I don't know if you want to. Talks about hazardous waste in containment buildings, and it says, then the question, I guess, is does the TSDF also have to add hazardous waste in a description on tanks? So we're talking about labeling here. We're talking about the generator requirements. So generators definitely have to use the words hazardous waste, and some description of the hazard on tanks as well as containers. If it's a TSDF and they're generating new waste in the treatment, they would have to meet the same standard.
Yeah, those are in 262.17A(5)(2), I think, like two little Roman twos, two little Roman I's. So that's where the tank labeling requirements are, I think. So if you want to go in and look at those. Well, if we don't have any more questions, I hope that this was useful. The team really hopes that it was useful to all of you guys, although we would love to, you know, be visiting California and Alaska and Oregon and Washington, if we can, and all the other states that are out there, Hawaii. This is a decent substitute, and we're glad to be able to reach you guys. And we hope that you've signed up for the next two sessions and bring your questions.
Okay, if it's all right, I'll go ahead and walk through some of those final reminders. And with that, I want to echo everybody's thanks for those of you who were able to join us for today's live broadcast. We did have nearly 250 individuals sign in for today's live broadcast, so thanks so very much for joining us. Just a few quick reminders before we let everyone go. First, for those of you who are looking for copies of the presentation materials, we do have those available as a resource, including the crosswalk matrix that was referenced earlier. That's available on the seminar resources page. You can simply follow the links on the middle of your screen. You'll find it under related URLs. Click on the seminar resources link to select it, and then hit the Browse to button to open that website up on your own computer. Information about our presenters and organizers can also be found on that seminar homepage. And I will ask each of you to take just a moment to fill out the online feedback form to let us know what you thought of today's delivery, including the way we delivered it and the content that was covered. Now, one of the most common questions we get is if we offer CEUs or PDHs for these types of webinars. While we don't offer those, we do give you certificates for joining us, which you can save for your own records, and oftentimes along with copies of your registration or the materials, they're enough to get you credit with your own accrediting institution. In order to access one of those certificates, you'll have to fill out the online feedback form. Please be sure you fill out that form completely and you check the box at the bottom to confirm you were present for the whole session. Once you check that box and send the feedback in, you'll immediately have access to a PDF form that you can either save or print out for your own records. Now, if you happen to be participating in a group, which I know many of you were joining together from conference rooms, each person can actually fill out that feedback form on their own, whether they registered individually or not. So you can each get your own certificate, even if you join together under somebody else's registration spot. And good news, if you happen to be one of the lucky people replaying the recorded version of today's webinar, you can still follow the links to the seminar feedback form under the related URLs box on the middle right and fill that out based off of your replay of the archived version. As noted, we're going to go ahead and push out a recorded version of this session. We should get that out in a day or two so that you'll be able to play it back before part two of the seminar series takes place next Tuesday. If you haven't registered for that part, I encourage you to go back to the communications you would have received about the seminar series and follow the links to those parts so that you can register for parts two and three, which will be coming up over the next 2 weeks. Once the archive is available, you'll immediately get an email from us letting you know how you can play that back. And so with that, I'll go ahead and thank you all one more time for joining us and thank the organizers and presenters for taking time out of their schedules to offer today's training. That's going to be the formal conclusion for today's live broadcast. We hope to have you on for the very next session in the series.